You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
When your listeners to the Cold War Conversations podcast want to experience the Cold War, there is no Cold War anymore. They can go back to the buildings that were there, and they can feel, you know, a little bit of the coldness in those buildings. And that's why we preserve architecture, to keep our memory of those places intact.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Today we welcome back Mark Baker from episode 9, where we spoke about his time in 1980s Czechoslovakia. Mark is a freelance journalist and travel writer living in his adopted hometown of Prague, where he's lived for more than two decades. Mark seeks out communist architecture in his hometown and further afield, and is the ideal candidate to discuss the question, why preserve communist architecture? Did you know that you can really help the podcast by leaving reviews in iTunes or with your favourite podcast provider? It really helps us get new guests on the show and publicise the podcast. If you'd like to support us, then head over to coldwarconversations.com and click on the Support the Podcast menu option to learn more. Thank you so much to all our fans that are supporting us. It is really appreciated. Now, back to today's episode. We welcome back Mark Baker. You know, the way that we sort of got into the idea for this episode was I came across your blog post about Carlo Vivari and the Hotel Thermal. Do you want to just tell me a bit about that particular place?
Yes, Ian. I think that the Hotel Thermal in Carlo Vivari is a great illustration for the question of why to preserve communist-era architecture. You've seen the photos from the blog post, probably. It's a building that obviously does not fit architecturally with the rest of Carlo Vivari. You know, just to give you an idea of what Carlo Vivari is, it's an old time spa town. Most of the architecture dates from the 19th century. So, you know, if you can picture very elegant wrought iron and woodworking, that makes a very harmonious spa, the kind of place that you would take an afternoon stroll, buy some of those wafers on the street. Carlo Vivari has this famous kind of cookie that you buy on the street, sipping from your porcelain mug of sulfuric acid. Basically, that's what it tastes like, in the hopes of taking the cure and thinking about all of the luminaries that have visited Carlo Vivari in the past. So, you know, we're talking about Russian czars, Goethe, Karl Marx was a visitor in Carlo Vivari.
What was its German name? Is it more familiarly known?
Yes, it's called Karlsbad in German. That's how everybody would know about it. Mariánska Lázeňa is the other one that's right next to it, and that is called Marienbad, you know, which is much better known in English by their German names. But anyway, so along comes the architectural planners, the Communist Party overlords of that town in the 1960s, and they have a very successful international film festival, still going on, by the way, and still it gets better and better every year. But already in the 1960s, the film festival was coming under competition from the Moscow Film Festival. So the organizers, the people in the city, they want to keep the film festival, the thing, the focus. So they hire some of the best young architects of the day to build, you know, something that would express, you know, the cultural richness, the heritage, the ideas that are springing out of this town in the 1960s. And they came up with the Hotel Thermal. It actually is not only just a hotel, but it also is the host venue for the film festival. So they have screens and projection rooms built into it. There are meeting rooms, etc. So it's a whole small complex there. Anyway, so they hired a young couple at the time, the McConan couple. They went on to do some very famous buildings in the 1970s in Central Europe for Czechoslovakia. And they built a building that was that really conformed to the most interesting, the most vital architectural ideas at the time, and that was a kind of brutalism. You know, I mean, I don't know if your listeners will understand, you know, brutalism, but I mean, just you know, just think about all of those government buildings and car parks in the middle of England. All those university buildings in the United States that were thrown up in the 1970s. It's kind of an exposed concrete exterior. All of the innards of a building are projected on the outside of the building. The idea was to become, to be very honest about what the building does, what the building is on the exterior of the building and not just on the interior of the building. You know, it was an exciting idea at the time. I mean, you know, a lot of those buildings haven't aged very well, admittedly. But that was the idea, you know, and that's the building that they designed.
And I think it's interesting when you make those comparisons with Western buildings, because then we're sort of saying that this isn't purely a communist idea. It was a general architectural genre that was developing at the time.
Yes, of course. No, it's funny. I was thinking about this conversation today and what we would talk about. And it's so fascinating for me to put myself in the heads of some of these architects in Eastern Europe, and not just in Czechoslovakia, but all across Eastern Europe. So think about architects all over the world. You know, they're dealing with all kinds of issues. You know, first off, they're dealing with their own creative impulse, their own ego to create. I mean, architects all over the world have that, in Eastern Europe, of course, as well. But then there are economic constraints, there are technological developments, and of course, there are fashion components to architecture. You know, architecture throughout the decades changes, you know, much like our clothing changes. I mean, you know, some things look old fashioned after a few years, and everybody's trying to design in that new fashion. Okay, so in Eastern Europe and in Central Europe, they also had to incorporate an ideological component to their architecture, if you will. You know, everything that they did had to be signed off by the planning board, by the local party bosses, etc. And each thing was second-guessed and reinterpreted just to make sure that it also, in addition to all these other things, expressed the kind of prevailing ethos of the socialist world. And, of course, that was changing a lot. So, I mean, these guys did not have it easy at all. I mean... You know, think about it. What is a socialist building? I mean, what is a building that actually evokes socialist or communist aims in the ideology, in the structure itself? It's a very amorphous subject to think about.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of these architects, and I guess that they're trying to sort of portray an image of dynamism and progress as well as egalitarianism. And possibly simplicity in that architecture to try and represent that ideology.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, well, okay. Let's talk a little bit about communist architecture and how the fashions evolved over the decades, and then try to discuss how architects would kind of fit their personal image into these various periods, you know, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, okay, so I think you can divide communist architecture into four or five different phases, and it really evolved in the decades after World War II, you know, in Central and Eastern Europe. At the beginning, say 1945 to say 1950, or until the death of Stalin in 1953, there was this desire across all of Eastern Europe to imitate exactly what was going on in Moscow at the time. And, you know, Moscow architecture, Russian communist architecture was a lot about exalting the working class. It was to, it was called socialist realist architecture. And it was, really, these are grandiose palaces. They're quite beautiful buildings in a way. They're quite hideous buildings, but but beautiful in kind of a hideous way. Those towers in Moscow, if you can recall, the Palace of Science and Culture in Warsaw is a good example of one of those buildings, in Central Europe. We have one in Prague, of course, too. It's called the Hotel International. It was designed and built in the 1950s here in Prague as a gift from the Soviet Union, of course. That style already by the 1950s felt old-fashioned. It felt a little bit out of touch. But hey, you know, Moscow, Russia was calling the shots after World War II, so you know, there was really nothing that the local architects could do to fight it. They just kind of went along with the flow. You know, we do have some nice buildings in Prague that are built in the style in the 1950s, in addition to the Hotel International, which is one of those soaring towers. but you can notice them by, you know, they're pretty big. They usually have some statues. They usually have some pro-socialist statues and motifs on the sides of the buildings, etc.
Yeah, so they're normally, I mean, I've been to the Palace of Culture in Warsaw, and certainly around the outside they have these stylized images of the workers.
Yes.
It's very much in that socialist realist style.
Yes, I personally love this style. And you talk about your email and Twitter that you're going to get after one of these episodes. But, you know, I'm sure that my friends wouldn't believe me if I actually told them. But I live right down the street from the Hotel International. I can see it from my balcony. And my neighborhood would be so much more boring if that building wasn't there. So, you know, it's kind of like a little piece of Manhattan somehow stuck right in the middle of a residential neighborhood in Prague.
And I think we'll get onto that controversy because, that you know, you take the Warsaw example, you know, there is or has been a lot of controversy around that building as to whether it should stay or whether it should go. But it's used on all the tourist information pieces as sort of like the logo.
Right. What would Warsaw be? Sorry, Polish listeners. What would Warsaw be without that building? You know, somehow the skyline looks like Dallas or Frankfurt or Houston. You know, otherwise, it's an interesting skyline. Warsaw has its own, you know, its own issues because, of course, the city was destroyed during the war and had to be rebuilt anyway in the 1950s and 60s. But yeah, you're right. That building lends an element of kitsch and character to the Warsaw skyline that actually is a plus, if you ask me.
So what would you say is the next phase then after socialist realism?
Right. Okay. So the death of Stalin in 1953 sets off sets off all kinds of changes in every aspect of life in Central and Eastern Europe, including architecture. At some point, it took a while for this, the death of Stalin and its aftermath to be felt in architecture, but it was essentially the end of socialist realist architecture in the Soviet Union and also in Eastern Europe. So what happens next is a push toward efficiency, I would say. Technologically, the 1950s was a big boom year in technology for industrial building and construction methods. So that meant that the type of buildings that we associate now kind of uniformly with the communist architecture, those panel buildings, you know, the buildings that are built from concrete reinforced panels and stacked one on top of each other into boxes. Yeah, prefabricated building technology really took off in the 1950s. So all around Central and Eastern Europe, you see experimentation in trying to build mass housing projects that are built straight from designs of panels, reinforced concrete panels built one on top of each other into boxes. You know, this reflected a kind of ethos, a sort of socialist fashion at the time, to try to do things in the most efficient manner possible.
Right.
You know, the war all over Europe, of course, and also in Central and Eastern Europe, created a massive housing shortage everywhere. You know, there was a kind of boom in the 1950s for housing construction, and that became a very important aim of the governments was to give everybody a house, right. Give everybody at least a roof over their own heads. And the way to do this the most efficiently and the most cheaply, you know, you have to say, is to rely on these kind of mass construction prefabricated methods. And that technology really got rolling in the 1950s.
And was that method used for, I get it being used for residential housing construction, but was that used for public buildings as well?
Yes, very much so. And will be continued in, you know, if there's a theme that moves forward from this point is that, you know, if socialist realist housing was about expressing, or socialist realist buildings were about expressing this monumentalism of socialism and communism, future building was more about expressing a kind of mass uniformity, say, or an efficiency, a technological efficiency. That was kind of the overriding ethos that drove planners and ultimately architects at that time all over the Eastern Bloc.
And was that style also used in the West as well? Was there a catalyst for moving to that style aside from the need to build a lot of houses very quickly?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, you know, there are public housing projects all over, particularly in France, in Germany, of course, in England as well, and in the United States. I mean, in the 1950s and 60s, this was seen as a kind of panacea. I mean, this is going to save us, it's going to save a lot of money, and it's going to give a lot of people housing. Of course, in the West, you know, that whatever that solution didn't always work out to be the best, simply for, you know, socioeconomic reasons, for all types of other types of reasons that, for the most part, they didn't really have to deal with in Eastern and Central Europe at the time. So I would say that on balance, those mass estates, those housing estates that use that prefabricated building technology were more successful in Central and Eastern Europe than they were in the West.
Right. And how long did this sort of futurist or retro-futurist style last?
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Well, that's funny because I wouldn't call this style retrofuturism. I would say this is just kind of the technological phase. In fact, that's even what the Czech architects now call the 1950s, the technological phase. But what might be interesting to your listeners is that there was a big turning point in the 1950s in architecture, and that does eventually lead us to retrofuturism. And that was the World's Fair in Brussels in 1958. That was, for both East and West, that was a kind of astonishing World Fair in terms of the styles that it set, in terms of the new aesthetic that it created. And it was very much this kind of retrofuturism. You know, if you can think of the Jetsons, you know, that old cartoon from the U.S. in the 1960s, or like the those kidney bean shaped tables in Germany called the Nierentisch. Did you ever hear that expression?
I've not heard that expression.
Oh, okay. But you can imagine it in your mind, right? 1960s, cool furniture, all that stuff. Anyway, the Czechoslovak Pavilion in 1958 took the top prize that year. And it was designed from top to bottom in a lot of these emerging aesthetic details. You know, just the knives and forks and the beer mugs in the beer drinking tent were all designed specifically for this World Expo and set a new tone of design. The Soviet pavilion was also very impressive. Almost all of the Eastern European and Central European pavilions were you know, tried to, you know, whatever, tried to anticipate these new aesthetic design changes that were coming. And it's no exaggeration to say that 1958, it really set the tone for the next decade, all the way till the Warsaw Pact invasion in 1968. You know, everybody was racing to build, how to describe it, kind of an optimistic look at the future about how it was going to be, to add conscious design elements that were built on geometric forms to incorporate new materials, not just prefabricated concrete, but also a bit of glass, a bit of plastic, a bit of, all kinds of different materials that were being developed.
And is this where all these amazing sort of like, I've seen photos of these bus shelters in the Soviet Union and stuff like that. Is that during that period where,
Yes. Those bus shelters may not have been built during that period, but those bus shelters were designed by architects that were looking at what came out of, ultimately what came out of 1958 Brussels Expo and lots of other things, of course. You know, maybe they weren't thinking about that expo when they designed it, but they were definitely feeding off that kind of impulse that was created at that exposition.
And was that style that, and I'm going to paraphrase here, the Eastern Europeans came up with at that expo copied in the West?
It was all borrowed and copied, I think. I don't even know if this was in a uniquely Eastern or Central European phenomenon. I think that type of style really took the world by storm. You know, think about the 1964 World Expo in New York City was also very much built on Futurama, looking to the future, the space age, the 1950s and the 1960s, just the development of all the new materials that came out of the 1950s and 60s from the space program and other things and the war. There was some type of optimism that was permeating, in the minds of designers and architects at that time. And that's basically what we got in the 1960s on both sides of the wall.
And what would you say are good examples of that either in Eastern Europe of that style?
I think there are lots of good examples of that style, actually. It's funny, but a lot of the housing projects that were built in the 1960s had those, they call it here, they call it the beautiful phase. At least the exhibition that I went to last year at the Museum of Applied Arts here in Prague. So you had those, you had those housing projects that were built, like we said, but in the middle of the housing project, there might be a kind of curve of the, hard to describe, but maybe some of the roofs. There were little statues, very futuristic looking statues. Maybe it was just a flower or some other kind of decorative element. Maybe that Alexander Tower in Berlin,
the TV
big thing
tower
with the ball on top of it. Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh,
yes. I don't know if that's a good example, but it's an excellent
I think
question.
It probably is a good example because it is that futurist style and a style that had never been seen before. And for East Germany, they wanted to use it as almost like a lighthouse to show the superiority of socialism.
Yes, there's a folly aspect to that kind of architecture, and there's also a kind of ideological aspect to the architecture. I mean, when you look at those buildings back then, now they look a little bit anachronistic and even a little bit kitschy. But back then, if you would look at that type of building and you would think, aha, that's what the future is going to look like. And that's the future that we're building here under socialism.
Yeah, and that would have been the subtext and the message that they wanted to underline there.
Absolutely. And it was important to do that. And of course, there was a lot of national pride when these countries would win these international awards, etc. Actually, I did think of a good example of one of these Jetson-style buildings that probably your readers will not know about. But there's a small town in the eastern part of the Czech Republic in Silesia. It's called Havíjov, and they built a train station there in the 1960s. Havíjov was one of those buildings that was created. That was one of these cities that was created after World War II. Mm-hmm. It was a mining town, and it was many of the buildings are built with this kind of socialist realist housing at the beginning. They were built in the early 50s. The worker housing there is kind of majestic. You might say now it's a bit run down. It doesn't look so nice, but at the time it was like, wow, these are miners and they're living in palaces. And to fit the grandiose ideas of the town at that time, of course, fashions had moved on. We weren't building socialist realist anymore, but we're going to build one of these retro futuristic train stations for our town. And if you look at it and take a step outside, it looks a lot like one of those 1950s, you know, transistor radios, or maybe a Zenith television set with the curves and stuff like that. If you go inside, it's a very light interior. There's a huge wall of windows on the front. The materials that they used, I mean, it's a very futuristic rendition of a train station that was built in the 1960s. It's cool. You know, I went there last year. I couldn't believe my eyes. And it fits very well in the debate that we're having today about preserving the architecture or not, because many people look at that architecture in the town and say, ah, that was built by the communists. It must be bad. So we're going to knock it down and forget about that whole period. It never existed. But I look at that, you know, I'm not affected emotionally, mentally, you know, I don't have memories of living under communism. I look at that and I think, what an exquisite example of the type of architecture that they wanted to build and they wanted to say with the buildings from that time, and it should be preserved.
It's interesting wanting to eradicate that period of history as a permanent memory. I mean, the example I sort of find weird is, you know, in Berlin, for example, the Reich Air Ministry from World War II, from the Nazi era, that was built by Speer, I think, is still used. And it was used by the East German government as a government building. Although it was probably nearer to the socialist realist style, you know, minus obviously the Nazi decorations around it. So it was probably a reasonable fit.
Right.
But it's sort of wanting to eradicate that recent history from memory it's a constant issue that comes up throughout the world, I think.
Right. And on the flip side of that is also not wanting to advocate too strongly to preserve it.
Yeah.
In a sense, if you know what I mean, it's like, it's not just an eradication thing. It's also, look, I don't want to go out there and say that I think it's worth preserving somehow, really sticking your neck out a lot. You know, I think a lot of the old Nazi buildings in Germany are kind of falling down. You know, there isn't a let's restore this, you know, movement really. I mean, there probably is, but it's not very strong or vocal.
Yeah. And
as far as I know,
it's accepting the architecture for the beauty of it. And obviously beauty is in the eye of the beholder, to use a cliche term. And, you know, some people will view it as a beautiful building. Others, you know, will not. One question I wanted to ask you is in East Germany, and as you can tell, that's probably more my area of speciality, they did used to use quite a lot of stained glass. Was that a trend also in Czechoslovakia and other areas of Eastern Europe?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was one of those materials that was sort of resurrected in the retrofuturistic 60s. You know, they were experimenting with different types of materials. They used a lot of ceramics on the sides of buildings back then. They used a lot of stained glass. They used a lot of blown glass, colored glass, tiles. You know, a lot of this, obviously, there's a nationalist component. I mean, not a nationalist component, but I mean, there's a national component to all of this, because at least in Czechoslovakia, there was a thriving, well, maybe not so thriving, but there was a traditional glassmaking industry, and there were glassmaking artists still around in the 1960s, and they were, you know, incorporating national tendencies into the artwork too, because that was also a phase that socialist architecture went through, to try to pull out, you know, the nation, the folk, the people, you know, into that whole discussion. And they used traditional arts and crafts like glassmaking as part of that effort.
So with the retrofuturism, is there an obvious end to that, or does it sort of merge into the later period? There's no strict delineation between any of these periods, I guess.
There is not, but you know, lucky or not, we do have some delineation. You know, we have the death of Stalin with socialist realist. You know, the technological phase goes up to Brussels, say. I mean, this is just very crudely, you know, sketched out. You know, you're right, there's no fixed dates on any of this stuff. Then suddenly we have this period, the beautiful period, where we have all these crazy buildings going up and some interesting ideas. Coincides with that period in the 1960s in Czechoslovakia, but also throughout Central and Eastern Europe, of a relative political freedom, a thaw. You know, we have Khrushchev, we have the struggle for power in Moscow. You know, we have a period where the Soviet domination doesn't appear as monolithic and as strong. And it gives this, and it gives into the 1960s under Khrushchev, it gives the feeling in these smaller countries that they have a little bit of wiggle room to be more creative. And then, of course, in 1968, if you want your endpoint, with the Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia in August of 1968, that pretty much all comes to an end. I think, you know, you're right when you say that there are not really specific endpoints to all these things. But I think in this case, I think the retrofuturistic phase came to an end with the Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia in August of 1968. You know, this hurt that effort in many, many different ways. You know, for one thing, it was a reassertion of Soviet dominance in Eastern and Central Europe, in all the countries. It was a reassertion that there is really one way to do things in Central and Eastern Europe, and that goes through Moscow, not through any of these smaller cities or countries.
So any continuation of, in Czechoslovakia, any continuation of the retrofuturism would have seemed a harking back to the Dubček era and therefore not acceptable.
This brings us right back to the hotel thermal,
I love it when it all comes around. It's almost as though we planned it, Mark.
Exactly, didn't we? The Hotel Thermal was designed in the 1960s. It was designed on the drawing board in 1964 and 1965. The couple that designed it, the Mekonnen couple, they were working among that. They felt the freedom to actually borrow from the West. That's why it's so strongly brutalist. You know, you couldn't, before that, you couldn't have, in Czechoslovakia, you couldn't have actually consciously adopted views, architectural points of view from the West. So obviously, in a sense, but they had that freedom. And then in 1968, we have all those changes. We have the Warsaw Pact invasion. Many of the artists and many of the the designers that helped to build and to help to furnish the Hotel Thermal were later kicked out of the party. You know, were found on the wrong side of that debate. You know, in 1968, they were among the losers. And somehow the whole project, I wouldn't say was discredited, but it certainly was altered in a sense. That building wasn't actually finished until about 7 or 8, 9 years later, something like that, 1976 or 1977, well into what the Czechs call the period of normalization.
So it was completed and it was still used, but no other buildings of that style were built.
Well, not of that retrofuturism, but now we're coming into a different phase in the after 1968. We have a period of normalization. We have a period of conservatism in architecture. We have a period of going back to that 1950s style. Let's just build houses for the masses. And we also have the hard to describe, really. I mean, it's like you said, there's nothing that's really hard and fast about any of this. It's all just making generalizations. But you have a kind of different type of style that came in, a kind of bulky style, a kind of state-sponsored brutalism. You know, we see this in many buildings that were built in Czechoslovakia in the 1970s. So not the lyric retrofuturism, but a lot of international influence still. You know, one good example of this is the Kotva department store in Prague, in central Prague. I don't know if your listeners will be familiar with that, but it's another one of those buildings, like the Thermal, that sort of stands right in the middle of an UNESCO-protected heritage site from a completely different era. But it's a stark, brutalist building from the 1970s that sits right in the middle of all this splendor. It's actually right next to the Art Nouveau, the municipal house in Prague. And it's a kind of cubed it's a kind of tile brick faced series of hexagonal cubes all sort of melded together with some kind of concrete sheathing on the front of it. I mean, it's a fascinating, fascinating building with so much texture to it, but it also happens to be...
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
You know, I don't want to say ugly, but it happens to be kind of unsettling if you're not into that style.
I've seen this on your blog, and we will be sharing links to Mark's blog and some photos. I think this is the one where even the interior has got this sort of hexagonal theme as well, isn't it?
Well, they came up on structural limitations when they were building the building because, the points that the load-bearing points of the building had to be respected, even no matter whether you're communist or capitalist or whatever, you still have to respect the laws of physics. And so they had to, build the load-bearing walls to support the hexagons. And so that meant that you have these kind of they almost look like trees in the middle of the store that hold up the structure.
It's almost like vaulted pillars throughout the building.
Yes,
almost going back to a Gothic style rather than a...
exactly. It's Gothic pillars, but Gothic pillars holding up ceilings that are only one or two stories high. I mean, it's ludicrous in a certain sense when you look at it. But at the same time, you feel the pressure that the architects were under to build buildings that they thought were artistically demanding, and they thought that they were artistically rewarding, but at the same time met the specific demands of the people who would be judging and approving these buildings. And, somehow when I look at Kotva, I see the whole ball of tension all wrapped up in that building.
I mean, are you aware of any buildings that failed to get permission to be built because they were thought to be ideologically dodgy, to use a phrase?
Many. I think there were many, I think what would happen then is that you would design, you're an architect working in some, working in some research institute in some Central or Eastern European country. You have your own personal ambitions. You have the own styles that you really like from all over the world. Of course, you can, you know about these things from whatever sources, but you realize that you have to work within a specific room, within a specific space, in all these different ways. So you put something to the planning board, it gets pushed back, you push it back, it gets pushed back, etc. So finally you come up with a sort of compromise structure that satisfies no one and satisfies everyone, basically. And that's the kind of building that you get. A good example of this is the Hotel Intercontinental in Prague. That was also a building that was built in this kind of 1970s. I hesitate to use the word brutalist because it is a brutalist building, but it's kind of a communist brutalist building, if you know what I mean there. Okay, so they also wanted to build, it was for an international hotel chain. They also wanted to build a building that would appeal to international travelers, that would show Prague to be one of these emerging international destinations, that would conform to all those aesthetic qualities that you associate with luxury and all that stuff. And so they built a building. It was basically in the brutalist style. It's, it's several stories high concrete thing. The exposed concrete is on the outside. It has it looks almost upside down from a certain perspective. It's got a kind of cantilevered support system that you can take a peek at. Anyway, it looks like one of those buildings that if it was in your own hometown, you'd say, well, let's just knock it down. But at the same time, it expresses that you know, that sort of compromise mentality that happened. And I actually kind of really like it as a building.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've stayed there. I think we had a conversation about the Hotel Continental before.
And then when I talked about this kind of push and pull between planner and between architect and planning commission, the planning commission ultimately wanted a building that would suit the surroundings of the building, which was part of the old Jewish part of Prague, actually the old Jewish ghetto, you know, if you will. And it had to meet certain aesthetic requirements to fit in with that part of the old town. So they kind of came up with a style of architecture that would get them past the planning commission that was called ghetto moderne, if you can believe it. So this is basically the way that these kind of buildings were built. You know, I mean, it was a push on part of the architects and it was a pull, you know, on the part of the planners. And eventually we got what we got. And I think on some level, the buildings are unsatisfying for everybody and maybe kind of lend itself to that, let's just tear it down mentality, because maybe the buildings aren't complete works of the vision of the architect, for example, that they do reflect a certain undue influence, maybe by the government or by the ideological constraints that somehow, I don't know, harm the building in some certain way. I mean, I'm just, you know, talking here and not really
knowing. Because obviously one of the most famous sort of communist buildings, let's say, is the Palace of the People in Bucharest.
Right.
Now, that style seems to be more socialist realist than, and it seems to be harking back to that era. Yeah, it was built in the 1980s. I'm not trying to demolish your complete argument here, Mark.
No, of course not.
You know, I know Ceausescu that was probably, not probably, but was absolutely influential in that design. But it's interesting, you know, that, as you said, there's no hard lines in these periods and there are various aberrations in between.
Exactly. It's so difficult to describe, but it's not socialist realist in the sense that you don't see those worker motifs necessarily on the exterior of the building. It's really hard to describe. It doesn't fit that paradigm perfectly well, but I'll tell you what it does fit pretty well. Part of the Ceausescu myth, or the myth of that building, of course, was to incorporate Romanian materials, you know, to really build it from the national perspective. And so, you know, I can't say that all of the materials there, but the glass, the marble, the wood, the brick, the cement, the workmanship, all of that stuff reflects that national tradition that Romanian was trying to do. So, I think you can look at that building not necessarily as a celebration of communism, but as a celebration of Romanian workmanship and craftsmanship. I mean, I'm really putting a very positive luster on a horrible building that should never have been built in the first place. Yeah. But if you can take something out of it artistically, you have to see it, I think, in that term.
And I think you're probably right, because during that period, you know, Ceausescu was trying to take a semi-independent line there and underline the strength of Romania as a separate country. So, you know, I think you can read that into it.
And there was a certain amount of wiggle room. You know, we didn't really talk too much about all the phases that socialism went through in all these periods, because, of course, you know, not only is our architecture changing, is technology changing, but also what it means to be socialist, or what are the overarching kind of ideological aims in socialism were changing a lot. At some point you go through an international phase where everything is, you know, all kind of orchestrated all around the world, you know, all the workers unite. And then at some, and other points, it's, to give more influence and power to the national tendencies, you know, what it means to be Polish, what it means to be Romanian, what it means to be Czechoslovak. And that was due a lot, in a large part, to satisfy, you know, political demands in the various countries for autonomy, and reflected the strength and weakness of Moscow. There were so many variables. So, you know, socialism itself was a moving target, you know, hard for these architects to hit, you know, sometimes.
Yeah, Yeah. And are there, you know, particular examples which you think are, you know, aside from the ones we've already commented on, are there particularly good examples that you think are more worthy of preservation than others?
You know, the question of preservation is really, really a big one. And, I was thinking about this today as we were, you know, thinking about our discussion tonight. And, you know, why do we preserve architecture anyway? I mean, I think it's a really good question. I think that's probably the basic question. You know, when we go to France on a holiday and we walk around all those grand cathedrals that were built 800 years ago, or walk into those castles, and, you know, we admire those insane structures that were built, you know, to reflect, say, the rivalry between the church and the king, you know, that pushed them into building these greater and greater structures just to attract the most attention. We're not visiting France today. We're stepping back into France how it was, you know, 800 years ago or something, and trying to feel that and trying to live that. And to a certain extent, preserving architecture in Eastern Europe, contemporary architecture, is going to help us to solve the same problem. You know, when your listeners to the Cold War Conversations podcast want to experience the Cold War, they can't. You know, they can't act. There is no Cold War anymore. They can't actually go to a Cold War, but they can go back to the buildings that were there in the Cold War, and they can feel, you know, a little bit of the coldness in those buildings. And that's why we preserve architecture, to keep our memory of those places intact. So I think the question you want to ask is, what are the buildings that are worth, you know, what are the buildings that really express memory the best, that are worth preserving that way?
So as a physical expression of that period of history, or a memory of that period of history.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that if we knock down all these buildings, or if we just kind of forget communism ever existed, etc., I think in a generation or two, even before that, we won't really even remember this period that well. It wasn't very long in history. It was a blip in a certain sense, you know, looking forward. So, you know, I think, you know, you have to ask yourself how much of it is worth remembering. And, you know, I think, and I think you think, that a lot of it is worth remembering. It's, you know, it was just a fascinating, you know, amazing period in history, probably never to be duplicated again.
It makes an interesting period for me, because it was influenced by ideology, whereas almost every other period of history is more about religion or nationalism or something else. And this period is relatively unique in terms of its ideological influence.
Exactly. Yes, yes, yes. It was very strongly ideological. You know, on some level, of course, it was a geographic power play. It reflected, existing technological conditions at the time, economic forces, etc. There were just many, many different variables that went into it. And architecture helps us to remember and helps us to understand the various phases of those of that period. You know, I think it would be a terrible mistake to simply say, well, that was a nasty period, we're not going to live through that again, let's just knock all these hideous buildings down. No, I don't think that's the right way to look at this at all.
And I think we see similar problems in the West, for example, where nuclear command centers or places like that, people are wanting to demolish them or not preserve them, or, you know, use them for something else. Whereas they are great in terms of understanding that paranoia and fear that pervaded the world during that period, which, as you say, is almost impossible. Well, you just can't reproduce it now, but there's no better way of telling a story than going to the physical place where some of it happened.
Exactly. And I think that part of the fun of architecture is, you know, not just whether the buildings are pretty or not. I mean, I think that's a pretty banal way to look at a building, actually. I mean, I understand it. Obviously, we want to be surrounded by things that we like and are attractive. But buildings tell a story. They really tell the whole, they tell an amazing story about, you know, just to go back to that Hotel Thermal again. Okay, the Hotel Thermal tells that tells the story of 1970s Czechoslovakia very, really very well. I mean, when you look at the interiors, when you look at the design, when you look at the artists that they employed, and the styles that they worked in, it's a real national effort to create something that looked like that. And I think it would just be a terrible loss to either renovate that building in a way that conforms to our 2019 idea of a beautiful building, or to, you know, to knock it down, or somehow neglect it to the point where it doesn't have this kind of magic anymore. You know, I'm not saying that we need to just live in the 1970s, but I am saying that that I think that we need to respect some of the workmanship and craftsmanship and design that went into that building at the time, because that period is never going to happen again. Every building reflects a unique period in time, and the best way to appreciate a building, I think, for me, is to try to get your head into that time. And you know, when we approach history, that's what we do as historians. We try to get into the heads of the people who lived in that time. So I don't know. It's very important to me. You can see that I'm kind of passionate about this, and I write about it a lot on my blog. And I find it very difficult to convince my friends and people around me that this is something worth doing. Sometimes, you know, a lot of people are sympathetic to it. I'm committed to doing it.
I think you'll find our listeners are probably a very sympathetic bunch to preserving Cold War history. So you have got a friendly audience here. Is there anything else you want to add to the story of communist architecture?
You know, it's funny when people visit me in Prague. You know, they do want to go see Prague Castle, and, you know, obviously that's a big thing, and the Charles Bridge and everything else. But a lot of times they tell me, okay, show me something from the Cold War. Show me something from, you know, give me some, you know, whatever. I mean, show me some communist architecture. I really want to see that. How was it? People are still fascinated by that period, you know, because of its uniqueness, also because of the cloak and dagger thing. You know, it was a scary time in history, you know, and so I find myself taking people, you know, to see the Hotel International near my house, or to see the nuclear bunker that was under the command bunker that was under Wenceslas Square, under one of the hotels there, to see some old fallout shelters and clubs that are in nuclear bunkers. You know, it's just it's a fascination. So, you know, you can't tell me that people are not interested in this. You know, they are.
Well, that's it for today's episode. But don't forget to visit the show notes at coldwarconversations.com, where there's links, videos, and details of some books to help you find out more about today's episode. If you can't wait for our next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where our guests and listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just go to coldwarconversations.com and click on the Join the Conversation option. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.